Yes? Good. So it's recording. All right. So we'll get that thing going eventually. So part two is, if you go back to the outline, I should have put the outline in front of these two. But part two is evidence about Jesus. And to me, this is the part that I'm most interested in, because this is the part that we can use to help people to become a Christian. All right. And of course, it can be used to defend the faith, no doubt. But I think our goal, as we're sharing Christian evidences, is people become Christians, right? So, you know, this stuff about the existence of God, that's really more, in a sense, a defensive thing. It's an offensive weapon, at least in some senses. Our Chinese friend, you know, who maybe could come to believe in God and eventually down the road could become a Christian. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about Jesus, which is, I always like talking about Jesus. All right, so we're going to be, there's going to be three main parts to this. The first part is going to be dealing with this question of who is Jesus. Okay? And so we're going to look at the claims of Jesus. And we're going to consider, oh good, it's up and going now. Great. We're going to be looking at the claims of Jesus, but we're also going to be looking at these people who say that Jesus is a myth. This is the latest, you know, these things come and go. You know what I'm saying? They just come and go. There's nothing new under the sun. That's what God said through Solomon. But the latest thing, certainly on the internet, that's for sure, is the whole idea that Jesus is a myth. He might have been an actual guy, but the Jesus in the Bible is totally invented by these believers who are kind of codging together a little bit of Horace, a little bit of Dionysus and all these other gods and Isis and all these kind of things. And it really, the essence of Christianity is, in fact, a myth. Okay? Well, I want to respond to that a little bit. I think that's a good thing to respond to. Okay? Before we do that, I just want to mention that if you're into this stuff, we have a certificate program in Christian apologetics. 10 classes. And for those of you who are going to be like campus ministers, I would think having a certificate in Christian evidences, it'll do two things. It'll make you a better minister. And number two, it might get you a job a little bit better. You know, that's something to be said. Just being practical. All right, so I want you to be aware of that. I brought one of the classes with me. So these are 10-hour classes. I would say one of our classes would be roughly the equivalent of a three-unit class. So in other words, if you took three of our classes, that'd be kind of the equivalent of one semester class at a university. So the entire program might be equivalent of saying taking about four classes, one semester, where that's what you did for one semester. All right. And if you're interested, the classes are $150 each, which maybe seem expensive to you, but if you go out and check other programs, that's dirt cheap. And, you know, you can take them wherever you are, at your pace, whatever. Yeah.
Cool. Are these classes like every 4 years?
No. They're when you're ready to take them, because they're on DVD. So I got, for example, if you wanted to take the ones back there, I think the one that's back there may be this class, actually, Jesus and Christian Apologetics. So you say, we want to take that class. Great. We send you the syllabus. You either buy the books or we'll send them to you. You read them. You look at the DVD, 10 hours. Take a test. Write a paper. There you go. 10 classes. Okay. Yeah.
Is this the same as AIM?
No, AIM, they have a thing on Christian evidence. It's just like, 3 hours as opposed to 100 hours. Okay? So, 10 times more than what we're doing here, for example, plus writing papers. So AIM does have a class on Christian evidences. It's a little thing. So that would be, like, one of our classes would be more than that entire class, and we have 10 of them. So there's a class on the existence of God. There's a class on archaeology and history of the Bible, a class on worldview, a class on world religions, a class on science of the Bible, reliability of the Bible, 10 of them. You go to my website, you'll see that. Okay?
When you get hooked up with that, just go to your website.
Yeah. Or just send me an email.
Oh,
okay. You know? Yeah, I think that program would be very useful, especially for campus ministers. This is the perfect audience to advertise our program. All right, great. So let me go forward here. So I mentioned the debate we did with Shermer, And I also mentioned the debate we did with Shmuley Pateach and Shabir Ali. We did another debate with this guy, Robert Price, who's one of these Jesus is a myth type guys. And he says it with a straight face. I don't know how he does it, but he'll say, you know, that the New Testament writers, they were reading about Osiris, and they were reading about Dionysus, and this guy from Tyana, and Horus, and all these other guys, and Krishna, and they just sort of created their version of that, the kind of the Jewishized version of that. And that's what Jesus is. Okay. He gave me that look like, yeah. You're kidding. But I'm telling you, this is out there. This is all over the place. And if you start taking, you know, New Testament 101 at MU, this is probably what they're going to present. I'm serious. All right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to talk about, you know, the whole liar, Lord, lunatic, or legend. The four L's instead of three. And that. All right. Great. So we'll talk about that a little bit. So who is Jesus? Sage? What do you think? We agree with that? Was he a sage? That's not a spice in your spice rack. Was he a sage?
Wise teachers.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a sage. Okay. Was he a prophet?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about liar? Mm-hmm. Crazy person? A sage. That's like a wise person. Like Buddha was a sage. He was like, you know, oh, can you tell me the meaning of life? And, you know, just a wise person. Okay, maybe with only human wisdom, but crazy person, Messiah, Son of Man, God in the flesh, legend, myth, man, important religion leader amongst many. You know, these are some different views. And I believe that the only rational view, oops, I forgot, this thing doesn't work on this. It's funny, it works there, it just doesn't work there, but oh well. I believe that he's the Son of God, that he's God in the flesh. All right, and so I want to talk about why that is. And this idea that he's a mythical figure, that we know almost nothing about him, actually. You know, even Robert Price would say, at least 50-50, there was an actual person, you know, from Galilee that, you know, started this, it was teaching these things. And all right, so we need to talk about that a bit. Okay? So this is our outline in brief. Very brief, since it's not going there. It's happening again. Oop. No, it's not. I hit the wrong button. Don't blame it on the tech guy. All right. So we're going to look at the claims of Jesus. We're going to look at Jesus compared to other religious leaders. We'll look at extra biblical sources on him, the witnesses, the prophecies. We're going to talk about this whole myth, Jesus and myth idea, and miracles of Jesus and the resurrection. So that's a lot of stuff. Oh, my goodness, that's a lot of stuff we have to go over. So we better do it right away. This is if you're taking the class, which you're not, but some of you will. It looks like Willie might be taking this class. That'd be great. All right. All right. And this is a great argument to just take out there on campus, right? There's people that they say they believe in Jesus, but they act as if they don't. What else is new, you know? And so there's some possibilities. Jesus was crazy, he's a liar, or he's the Son of God. Those are three pretty different conclusions, you know? All right. And the thing is, the average person thinks Jesus was a really great guy. In fact, one of the best ever. All right? But you have to understand, that's not rational. That's not rational. That doesn't make sense. To say he's a good guy. You know, he was, you know, Mother Teresa and Buddha and, you know, and, I don't know, Muhammad. He's a great guy. But if you look at what Jesus said about himself, that doesn't make sense. That's crazy. All right, so because Jesus says some things about himself that are off the charts.
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm.
And there's, I suppose we could argue that he never said those. So that's why we have to talk about the reliability of the witnesses. We have to talk about what other historians. You know, we have to establish that. That's part of what we have to establish is that, you know, it's reasonable to assume that what the Bible says he actually said. But if he said what the Bible says he said, than anything other than bowing and saying, away from me, I'm a sinful man. God in the and anything short of that is doesn't make any sense. In other words, the response of 99% of Americans to Jesus doesn't make any sense. All right, so we have to talk about the claims of Jesus. Now, Jesus made some pretty amazing claims. All right, he claimed that he fulfilled the entire Old Testament. Everything that was written in the Old Testament was about him. Well, we had a whole lesson on that yesterday. I don't know if it got recorded. But if it did, you might want to listen to that. It did get recorded. It's on Facebook. All right, so go there. All right, Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. Well, let's read John 8:46. That's a good one. John 8:46. Let's start in verse 45. Yet because I tell you the truth, you do not believe me. Can any of you prove me guilty of sin? If I'm telling the truth, why don't you believe in me? I'm going to pick on Willie because he's married. Willie, I'd like you to just if you don't mind, say for me these words. Can anybody prove me guilty of sin?
Can anybody prove me guilty of sin?
I mean. His wife. I mean, who in all history has made the claim that they were without sin? Right? And Muslims have a problem with this because they say that their prophets were virtually perfect. You know, but there's just a slippery thing. You know, that's why they don't. They say that, you know, it shows David committing immorality with Bathsheba. They say that it didn't happen. They don't have any evidence for that. That's basically arguing from presupposition. But Jesus said, I am without sin. And the people who had been around him his entire life, who'd known him, they'd been with him day after day, his enemies, who'd seen everything he'd said and done, the only response was to say, you're crazy. that's not the question. He said, can anybody prove me guilty of sin? And the answer of everybody was silence or to change the subject. I don't know. Jesus is not like other religious leaders. Jesus is not in the same league with, say, Buddha. Would Buddha have claimed to be without sin? By the way, I like Buddha. I mean, everything I know about him, seriously, I never met the guy, but everything I know about him tells me that I kind of like him. I like his philosophy. I like his thinking about life. I like a lot of what the advice he gave. I think he's a pretty good guy. Whether Muhammad was a good guy, that's more debatable. Maybe, possibly, on some level, maybe in his time, relatively, kind of. All right. You know, Moses was pretty good, but you know, he kind of lost his temper there. And, you know, and Abraham, he kind of lied a few times, and you know, Jesus said that he was without sin. Kind of puts him in a separate category. How about John 8:58? Right down the page. I tell you the truth, Jesus answered, before Abraham was born, I am. And notice their response. At this, they picked up stones to stone him. You can see up there, you know, the claim and then the response. And this idea that Jesus is, you know, one of many religious leaders, great religious leaders, sages, prophets, it doesn't square with what the Bible says about Jesus. Jesus said, I am a transcendent, self-existent being. That's big fancy words. He didn't say before Abraham was born, I was. No. He said, before Abraham was born, I am. And I know one thing for sure is the crowd knew what he was trying to say.
Yeah.
He's saying, I'm God.
Sure.
I'm the creator of the universe. I am the pre-existent one. The one without whom there would be nothing. All right. Just imagine. Imagine your friend saying, "I'm God."
Yeah.
And you're laughing. And they're saying, "Excuse me. Why are you laughing? I'm God." Yeah. No. I'm, you know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
At this point, you know the guy is crazy. Now, C.S. Lewis is liar, lord, or lunatic. You know, when C.S. Lewis created that liar, lord, or lunatic argument, nobody had the nerve to even create the fourth alternative. Liar, lord, lunatic, or legend. I mean, even the whacked out crazy unbelievers didn't propose that ridiculous idea that Jesus wasn't even real.
Yeah.
You know, nobody even needed to argue against that. But believe it or not, today you have to. John 11:25. Jesus had this interesting pattern. He'd make a claim which either is crazy or it's like, you know, he's a liar, but a pretty strange kind of liar. I mean, you know, why would you tell that lie since it's going to get you killed? Or I guess he's who he said he was. If so, wow, he's kind of not in the same range with any other human being. John 11:25. I'll start to verse 23. Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha answered, "I know he'll rise again at the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die." She says, "I'm the resurrection of life." Yeah. Again, imagine your friend saying, "I'm the resurrection and the life." You know?
Wow.
And now, of course, we could deal with the question, did Jesus really say this? But these people said he did. And I'm going to talk about how reliable these witnesses are. Right? The fact that, you know, if this was a conspiracy, it was sure an unusual conspiracy. You know? And we were talking about your Chinese friend. Somebody mentioned, what about sharing with my Muslim friend? I do think that if you can get your Muslim friend to read this scripture and ask your Muslim friend, how do you feel about this? I mean, seriously, how do you feel about this? Jesus said, before Abraham was born, "I am." Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life." I mean, I'll tell you right now, Muhammad never said anything like this. Why not? Because they would have laughed him out of the building.
Yeah.
You know what's amazing? Jesus said this, and they didn't laugh him out of the building.
Yeah.
Now, they tried to kill him, but they didn't laugh him out of the building. If Muhammad had said, "Can any of you prove me guilty of sin?" Blah, 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 blah. The guy lost his temper. It's in the Quran he lost his temper. And they try to explain it. John 14:6. You know? "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." You know, and if Jesus said these things, then either he's crazy. But again, it doesn't show any of the signs of craziness. We know crazy people. I hate to go back to it, but I think I might have met one yesterday. But all right. Somebody has at least a somewhat tenuous grasp. But Jesus, nobody, the thought that Jesus did not have a good grasp on reality was something that nobody even thought of. He expressed himself very, very clearly. You know, Jesus was crazy. That doesn't make sense. The idea that Jesus was trying to create this conspiracy is a lie, to create a conspiracy. Conspiracy for what? To get killed. All right, great conspiracy. You know, Joseph Smith, and Joseph Smith's an interesting character. At some point, I try to understand that guy, because at some point, I believe this. I really believe this. At some point, Joseph Smith realized that where he was going was going to get him killed.
Yeah.
And he didn't stop. That's interesting. He's the only religious character I know who could be described that way. Joseph Smith, he's an interesting character. I've got a book about Mormonism back there. Get a copy if you want. But Jesus was not crazy and he was not a liar. And yet he said, "Can anybody prove me guilty of sin?" He said, "Before everyone was born, I am." He said, "I'm the bread of life." He's the bread of life. I mean, Jesus is the bread of life in that he's the bread of life and he's the bread of life. He's both. If you read that thing, he says both. "I'm the bread of life and I'm the bread of life." He said it with a straight face. And thousands of people believed it. Even the ones who walked away believed it. And they walked away because they believed it. And the ones who stayed because they believed it. And I think we need to confront people with Jesus. I really believe that. All the arguments, all this stuff. You know, I think maybe just sit down with an atheist and read this. I remember the first time I read John, I was an atheist. And I heard John and I was absolutely blown away. I wasn't ready. It turned me towards God and I kind of, you know, that's a long story. It was a couple years later that I became a Christian, but so we're talking about Jesus and Joseph Smith and Confucius. You try to put them in the same group. You know, Joseph Smith, if you know much about him, Joseph Smith and Jesus, trying to put them in the same category, it's like, that is ludicrous.
Right.
It is beyond ludicrous.
Yeah.
Would Confucius have said, "Before Abraham was born, I am"? No, he was a government official. He just was trying to tell how to have a good government and how to have a peaceful society. And, you know, probably most of his advice was actually pretty good advice. Okay? Or how about Baha'u'llah? The Baha'i. I get a fair number of emails from Baha'is, believe it or not. And they're trying to say the Bab is the reincarnation of John the Baptist and stuff like that. Lao Tzu, Taoism, Buddha. Can't read that. What's that cartoon? I can't remember. Thank you for your drawing, Billy, but now we have to kill you. He drew a picture of Muhammad in a little arrow there. Joke there. Moses. Would Moses have said, "Before Abraham was born, I am"? Would Moses have said, "I'm the resident"? No. So is Jesus a guru, a prophet? I guess he's a guru. A guru is a guy that a bunch of people follow. And yeah, I guess he's a guru.
Yeah,
yeah, the apostles. He was a guru. He was a prophet. Is he one amongst many? No. We need to kind of get that out there. We need to get that out on campus. Mm-hmm. Who's Jesus? I think we should do some Bible talks on just who is Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, that does... lead to the question of, I mean, put it this way, if the New Testament is describing what Jesus said accurately, then how could you not be a Christian unless you figure, well, you know, these guys said, you know, after Jesus raised Lazarus, these guys who went back and said, "We need to kill him," did they believe that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead? Yeah.
Yeah,
that's why they wanted to kill him.
Right.
All right. They realized you got to deal with this guy Jesus. That wasn't, you know, they knew that, but their response was kill him. That's rational, at least. The idea, yeah, I believe in Jesus, and you know, I might even go to church on Easter. You know, but that's a person who's not actually seen Jesus. So we have to talk a little bit about. So how do we know the things that are said about Jesus that are actually true? So we could talk about some of the historical sources here. We have Tacitus. I don't know if I should read all this. Tacitus, who clearly said, yes, there were Christians. Yes, there was a man named Crestus, a man named Christ, who was killed during the reign of Tiberius. who was killed under Pontius Pilate. So we know a few things about him from Tacitus. He was an actual person. He was a Jew, lived in Judea. He lived and was killed by crucifixion under Tiberius. So we've got some information there. Okay, Josephus. Now, the problem with Josephus is there's a quote from Josephus, which is a pretty good quote. You see the yellow stuff? What happened was there was what's called an interpolation. To interpolate is to take something and kind of fill in the gaps, essentially. But in this case, there were no gaps. So probably a well-meaning, but nevertheless, with hindsight, very, very foolish Christian interpreter read Josephus and added these things in the yellow. We know this for two reasons. Number one, the things in the yellow, it really doesn't make sense that Josephus would have said that. The things in white, it makes perfect sense because he's just reporting what happened. That's one reason. Another reason we know it is that there's another version of Josephus's Wars of the Jews, all right, in which it's in Arabic. It was translated into, might have been Arabic. It was from around the 4th or 5th century that doesn't have the stuff in yellow. So it's not in the Latin, the original. It's in another language. It doesn't have the stuff in the yellow. So let's read the stuff in white and skip the stuff in yellow. This is Josephus, who is a Jewish historian, who was born around 30 AD. He was born about the same time Jesus died. He was a general on the side of the Jews during the Jewish Wars. He switched sides, which wasn't very nice of him. He kind of became a traitor. He started working for the Romans. He ended up being in Rome and became a very well-known historian working for the Roman emperors. Okay, good. About this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was one who wrought surprising feats and was a teacher of such people as accepted the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing amongst us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. For the prophets of God had prophesied these countless other marvelous things about him, and the tribe of Christians so called after him has still to this day not disappeared. So if you take out the stuff in yellow, he's just saying common knowledge about what people claimed about Jesus. So clearly from Josephus and Tacitus, and we'll see a few others, the fact that Jesus was a real person, clearly established. The fact that he was a teacher to the Jews, clearly established. The fact that, at the very least, it was claimed he worked miracles. You know, whether Josephus is saying he worked bona fide miracles is perhaps debatable, but clearly he's reporting that everybody knew they claimed he worked miracles. That's well established. Where he died, when he died, and how he died are all established by outsiders. Yeah.
Was Josephus considered to be accurate with all the rest of his?
Josephus was quite accurate, except in numbers. In other words, if you read Josephus, if he said this happened, it happened. If he says this many people died, he tended to exaggerate the numbers. But Josephus is quite reliable.
Do we know if he became a Christian?
Almost certainly didn't. I mean, I can't prove. If he did, it had to have been at the very end of his life. Yeah, he didn't become a Christian. In fact, if he'd become a Christian, he might have said the stuff in yellow. If he was a Christian, he might have said that whole thing, including if indeed one ought to call the man, and he was the Messiah, and on the third day appeared to them, restored to life. Because if you believe the things in yellow, I've heard arguments like, there are no examples of anybody other than Christians that said he was raised from the dead. Well, no kidding. So what you're saying is, I need to give you proof there were people that believed that Jesus was raised from the dead that aren't Christians. You know, that's not exactly a reasonable request. You know, we need evidence that he raised Lazarus from the dead by writers other than Christian writers. You know, how's that going to happen?
Right.
Now, I think everything that skeptics could reasonably ask, we have. And the things we don't have are the things which are not reasonable requests anyway. You have to understand, we don't know that much about the ancient world. They say, man, hardly anybody wrote about Jesus. Well, hardly anybody wrote about anybody that we have. There are more references to Jesus than there are to Tiberius. You know who Tiberius is? Tiberius is the guy who was an emperor when Jesus was killed. Believe it or not, this might sound hard to believe, but it is a fact. There are more actual historical written references we have still have to Jesus than there are to Tiberius, the emperor. We know very, very little about this time. It's hard to exaggerate, even to appreciate how little we know. And the fact that we know this much from historians, it's almost as if that's part of God's inspiration to even have that there at all. And these expectations of the skeptics, it's amazing what they do. They'll believe anybody but a Christian. They'll believe Josephus. They'll believe Tacitus. They'll believe Suetonius. They'll believe Pliny the Elder. They'll believe this, that, and the other thing. But let's say, one of the early Christians said something about Jesus. Well, that's not evidence. On what basis is every form of evidence, except from a Christian, evidence? But if a Christian says it, it's obvious they're a lie. Well, if you're going to say that, you need to give me evidence that Christians by nature are liars. Yeah. But the problem is, Christians by nature are not liars. But that's the thing. People get intimidated by these arguments. It's like, you know?
Yeah.
Seriously, they rule out every single thing ever said by any believer in Jesus as obviously not true.
Yeah.
Or as not evidence. But the thing is, these people don't apply that to any other question.
Right.
None. Well, why is that? I think it's because Satan is at work.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, we as Christians, we have to just kind of put up with it.
Yeah.
You know, that's our burden, if you will, to just deal with this bizarre fact that they assume that whoever wrote the Gospel of John is lying through his teeth about every single thing he said. You know? See, they rule out the use of the Bible as evidence for Jesus. You know. Anyway, that's just where we're at. That's why we have to do this. You have to do this. You just have to. If you're going to defend Christianity on campus, you have to be prepared with some of these things. All right. So anyway, next is from the Talmud. On the eve of the Passover, they hung Yeshua. Now, I'm pretty sure that's Jesus. Pretty sure. And the crowd went forth for 40 days beforehand, declaring that he's going to be stoned for practicing witchcraft, for enticing and leading Israel astray. So even the Jews, the Talmud is Jewish writings of the late 1st century, possibly early 2nd century. Even the Jews said, well, he did witchcraft. Well, isn't that the same thing they said about him in the Gospels? By the power of Beelzebub? And so even the Jews felt like they had to explain these miracles that Jesus worked, that everybody knew he worked. You know, how can you explain the rapid rise of Christianity if we don't establish that, at the very least, the apostles certainly believed he was raised from the dead? I would say it is a fact, an undeniable fact, unless you just don't even care about even whether anything's true at all. Well, let's not say it's a fact that Jesus was raised from the dead for now. Let's just say it's a fact that the apostles believed he was. Alright? I mean, there's no other way to explain the rise of Christianity than we accept that that's true. Now, if they believe he was, then how can you say that they're lying? I mean, you know, anyway. So, in the Talmud then, they say he was an enticer, etc. So we know that it was common knowledge in this part of the world that Jesus lived, he was a teacher, he had massive crowds following him, that he worked signs, wonders, and miracles, and that he was killed by crucifixion. That's established. So those who say he's a myth have to deal with at least that. Anyway, Suetonius, as the Jews were making constant disturbance at the instigation of Crestus, expelled in Rome. Not a whole lot from Suetonius, a little bit. Lucian of Samosata, a little bit more. Not a lot of new information from him. Pliny the Younger, that talked about the fact that the Christians were celebrating the death and resurrection of Jesus. Is that mine? That's so annoying. Mm-hmm. That's terrible. Okay, I'm going to... Oh, I just hung up on somebody. Sorry. My phone never rings. That happened in class one day. I was teaching a class, and this phone started going off, and I stopped class. Kept going off. Then like, oops. I give everybody one. All right, Pliny the Younger, who talked about the fact that these Christians lived amazing lives and all this kind of stuff. I'm going to skip that for lack of time. You can find this later. Thallus, to me, Thallus is the most interesting one. We know of him only from a 3rd century Christian historian named Julius Africanus. He was writing in the 50s AD, and he's trying to explain the darkness that came on the land when Jesus died. This is a pagan who's trying to explain the darkness that came on the land when Jesus died. Now, this is in 50 AD. People say, oh, that's 20 years later. 20 years is nothing. I mean, I purposely didn't point out that I knew you when you were a little kid, Willie, but I'm pretty sure I remember. I'm pretty sure that my memory is still good enough that, yes, it's true, I did meet him. I haven't seen his parents for 20 years, but I remember meeting his parents. Do you think I made that up or something? 20 years is nothing.
Right.
People say, oh, the gospel was written for ages after Jesus died. No, they're written 30 years later. I remember being in graduate school. That was 35 years ago. I'm pretty sure that my memory of that is, more or less intact.
Right.
This idea that they couldn't have written an accurate account 30 years later, do you realize how foolish that is? And that's what they're claiming. It's a myth. The idea that they could have written this book describing all the miracles that Jesus did and have published it widely in the same area where he lived, and people would not have said, hold on a minute.
Right. Yeah.
That defies common sense. And that's what these people believe. Anyway, so basically what this guy Thallus said is, the reason it turned dark at midday is because there was a total eclipse of the sun. Now that tells me a couple of things. Number one, at the absolute minimum, we can say that in 50 AD, before any of the Gospels were probably written, but maybe not Mark, at 50 AD, it was common knowledge that the Christians were teaching, absolute minimum, that Jesus had been crucified and that when he died, it became dark in Jerusalem. Now, whether we can say it proves it happened or not may be debatable. What we can say is, in the year 50 AD, a pagan, this knowledge was so widespread that a pagan felt like he needed to write something explaining, and he says it was a total eclipse. There's a problem with that. One thing we can say absolutely for sure, there was not a total eclipse in Jerusalem in 30 AD on April whatever, nowhere near. I mean, that's fact, because a scientist can calculate every total eclipse of the sun that's happened in the last 50,000 years, can tell you exactly where and when. All right, so that his explanation is not right. But isn't that sort of cool?
Yeah.
Thallus. I mean, we have established by a pagan that at the very least the darkness happened, or either that or these people believed it even though they were there and they made it up, or some, talk about a mass hallucination. That's really a mass hallucination. All right, and obviously there were thousands, there were many, many thousands of Jews in Jerusalem that also experienced it, some of who weren't believers. And you know how it is with liars. Have you ever known somebody who's a pathological liar?
Yeah,
those people are hard to deal with. That's really tough. But anyway, what they do is they give you as little information as they possibly can, right? So they kind of leave room, because their practices, they give you as little information as they can, so that when you start asking them questions, they can kind of change their story and adapt it, so they kind of drag you along and drive you crazy. But that's not what the gospel writers did. They gave stuff like 30 pieces of silver. 30. How many? 30.
Yeah.
And there's all these details that which are not even obviously necessary to the story that are there. The reason they're there is because that's what happened. That's why they're there. But the thing is, if you were to make up a story 1,000 years later and put this in, how would you know? But I'm saying these things were being publicly declared in front of tens, hundreds of thousands of people even.
Yeah.
within 10, 20, 30, 40 years of the original. And I'm sorry, but if you think people forgot what happened 40 years ago, I'm sorry. I'm 58 years old, but I lived in Monroe, Connecticut when I was born. That is accurate information. All right? It's as reliable as the fact that you're sitting there right now. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, so the idea that Jesus is a myth and that the entire story about his miracles and his resurrection was made up 50 years later by a bunch of people trying to create a story to get people to believe in a religion that they're all getting killed for.
Right.
That is absurd.
Right.
And don't be intimidated by this crap. Do not be intimidated.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Are these witnesses reliable? Well, we know James got killed because Josephus mentioned it. James, the brother of Jesus.
Yeah.
Now, if Jesus was a liar, I mean, his own brother believed that he was the Son of God, that he was God in the flesh. We know that.
Wow. Yeah.
How do you know that? You know,
yeah.
He got killed for it.
Right.
We know when, we know where. We know who. Unless Josephus made up the story, why would he do that? Okay? James, the brother of John, was killed. Peter and Paul. Now, you know, Eusebius reports, Eusebius was a Christian historian from the early 4th century, and he reports that all the apostles were killed and how, and except for John. You know, I would say probably those stories are true. Why would he make them up? But I would say, from a clear-headed perspective, we could say that probably those, I wouldn't want to bet my life on all those, but I would bet my life that Peter and Paul were killed in Rome. The evidence for that is overwhelming. There's almost no doubt about it. And by the way, probably Peter is actually buried beneath St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. It probably is. I would bet it. I would bet 90% at least that he is actually buried there, you know, for what it's worth. But here's the point. So the people who say that these guys made up this story, made up the fact that Jesus is God, that he was raised from the dead, that he said before Abraham was born, I am, and all this stuff. These people, they're claiming that these people were lying about the whole thing. So this guy got killed and they're thinking, all right, man, our leader's gone. All right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to steal his body, and we're going to create this story that he said these things. He didn't really say it, but, you know, we want to have a nice religion. We get a lot of people to follow us, because then we're going to be rich, and we're going to have people saying great stuff about us, and, you know, we'll have big houses, and, you know, and we'll get on the television, and people will send us money. It didn't quite work that way, did it? They all got killed. In fact, these supposed conspiracy people who made up this thing, they spent the rest of their life in fear of death at any moment.
Yeah.
How many of them later said, oh, I was just kidding? You know, if you read a Book of Mormon, there's those three, you know, the three witnesses. If you read the Book of Mormon, at the beginning of the Book of Mormon, they have the three witnesses and then they have the 10. Those three guys all apostatized from Mormonism. All three of them. Under how much pressure? Not as much pressure as the apostles got, I'll tell you that. Although, to tell you the truth, there was a fair amount of pressure. The Mormons were pretty persecuted. All right. And then of the, I think it's the 10, I can't remember, it's in my book, I think 8 of those 10 also apostatized from Mormonism. All right. And I'll tell you this. If any of the apostles had later on said, oh, we're just kidding, they would have been paraded everywhere. I'm telling you, if there was a single example of even one person who said later on, I was there in that room when we made up that conspiracy, we were just kidding, then they would have been paraded everywhere.
Yeah.
But there weren't any. So I believe these are reliable witnesses. You're saying whoever wrote the Gospel of Matthew made up the whole thing and he's a liar. Okay. All right, fine. Okay, that's a premise. Now give me a reason to believe that.
Yeah.
Give me some evidence that the apostles were anything other than the New Testament portrays them to be, which is people are convinced that Jesus was the Son of God, and that they gave their lives for every, you know. So these people are trying to get you to believe something that just doesn't make sense. I believe that these are reliable witnesses. And if they weren't reliable witnesses, but the problem is there's lots of witnesses, and they're all saying the same thing. So maybe one of them wasn't reliable, but they're saying the same thing. And it's kind of cool. You know, we have four Gospels. And you know, the four Gospels, people go after them because they report different details. Therefore, they're contradictory. First of all, they're not contradictory. What they are is they're complementary. The reason they're different is because you have different witnesses. I was a juror in a trial, and this guy had, you know, stabbed his sister with a knife. It was a pretty bad situation. And we all these eyewitnesses, they came in, and they told their stories. And one person said, this happened. The other person said, that happened. And as we're listening, it's like, it's kind of confusing in a way. But then, at the end of the day, you added up all their stories, and they made a complete story. And it's kind of... They didn't contradict. They just saw different things and reported different details. In fact, if their stories agreed, well, that would tell me one thing, which is they colluded.
Right.
So the fact that their stories did not agree exactly made their stories more believable. Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what we have in the Gospel.
Yeah.
It's exactly what we have in the four Gospels. Because if they said the same thing, then why even have four?
Right.
And if they said the same thing, we would know one thing, which is there was really just one source,
yeah.
But there's four different sources. And now, Luke is a little bit different because he was interviewing eyewitnesses. All right, Matthew and John were eyewitnesses. Mark probably was. May have gotten his information from Peter. All right, and then the embarrassment factor. You know, if the apostles were eyewitnesses, were making up a story. Let's say you're making up a story. Let's say you're Peter. And you're going to present the story, and you're not going to make yourself look like a total idiot.
Right.
I mean, these apostles, they were, you know, you just shake your head.
Right.
And they were written in a time and place. I mean, it is a fact that the Gospels were distributed in Jerusalem when many of the people who were there when Jesus lived were still alive. 70 A.D. Right? How many of you right now in this room, what percentage will be alive 40 years from now that are in this room right now? Probably over half. Probably. So the idea that they could have distributed a conspiratorial fiction about Jesus and distributed in Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and at least three of the Gospels were written by 70 A.D. All right, that's fact. All right, and the idea that they could have written that, people would have not remembered well enough to point out, wait a minute, that didn't happen. Anyway. 1 Corinthians written 55, Galatians written in 49. Mark was written probably by 60 A.D., I believe it was. Certainly by 70, that's for sure. And people say, well, obviously... Matthew wasn't written until after 70 A.D. because it reports a prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem. That's circular reasoning. All right, you got that? And same thing with Daniel. They say, obviously, Daniel was written after 167 A.D., but that's circular reasoning. In other words, the reason they say we know that Matthew was written after 70 A.D. is because it reports the prophecy of the destruction of Jerusalem. Right, that argument only works if you have the presupposition that the Bible can't be inspired by God. But the fact is, all the evidence says, no, it's before 70 A.D. So why did they ignore that evidence? Well, there you go. And again, we shouldn't be intimidated by these people. How about Luke as an amazing historian? Let me see here. Compare to the Book of Mormon. Was that slide up there? Maybe it wasn't. Sorry about that. Galatians in 49 A.D., 1 Corinthians 55. And by the way, even the skeptics agree with these dates, by the way. These dates are coming from the people who hate Christianity and don't believe in Jesus. They'll tell you. I had somebody send a question to my website. How do you know Paul lived? But Paul is probably a fictional character. I mean, I'm telling you, even the most radical skeptics who hate Christianity, hate the Bible, and don't believe in God, they say, well, obviously Paul lived.
Right.
How could you even ask that?
Right.
All right, let me see. Next, Ramsey. This is Ramsey about Lucas, an amazing historian. I'm going to skip that. It's too much information. All right. So let's talk about messianic prophecies. Let me. I think what I'm going to do is skip the messianic prophecies for now. Don't worry, I'm going to do them. There we go. Yeah, they're towards the end. Oh, maybe what I could do. No, I'm going to skip the messianic prophecies for now. All right, just because. Okay. Oh, my goodness, I just went through 70 slides. So I'm in trouble here. So, let's just say this for now. The messianic prophecies, those are pretty good evidence for Jesus. We'll skip it for now. All right. Jesus fulfilled historical foreshadows. That's an advanced topic, although I did that in the lesson yesterday. Let's talk about Jesus as a myth. I don't have a lot of time for this. Jesus is a myth. So the whole idea is the idea of Jesus in the New Testament is a reproduction, a sort of a reformulation of ideas about Adonis, Osiris, Thammuz, Dionysus, Mithra, Krishna, Apollonius, Tyana, Peregrinus, Empedocles, Attis, all these people. Now, there were a number of God-man myths. All right, and so the idea is the Jews, a certain sect of Jews, wanted to create a God-man myth for Judaism, so they made Jesus into this God-man myth. All right, and they'll say that that's where this idea came from. It was just a creation, a sort of a compilation of these things. All right. Now the problem with this is it doesn't make any sense. That's a minor problem. All right. So the idea that a Jew would take an Egyptian myth and incorporate it into Judaism and create it, that alone is really a massive stretch. So what they're saying is, in fact, we had this debate with Robert Price, and Doug tried to tie him down. And these guys don't like to be tied down. They don't like it. All right, he said, tell me your best example. In other words, tell me which mythological figure, admittedly mythological figure, is the best candidate that they stole the story of Jesus from. And this was his. It was Osiris. Okay, now let's see if this makes sense. He was killed by his brother. See? No, that's not working. Okay, fine. His body was cut up into 13 pieces. Okay, I could see that. All right, sure. His wife, Isis, reassembles and sews those pieces back together. See? Like the 12 apostles and the 13th. You see? He comes back to life. He goes to rule in the underworld to judge the living and the dead. So the gospel writers picked up their description of Jesus dying and being resurrected and having 12 apostles. They'll say, he didn't have 12 apostles because Mithra had 12 apostles. And that's where the 12 apostles come from. I'm telling you, this is all over the internet. And this is, people accept this as obviously true, and they think you're silly for believing in Jesus, all right? I think probably the reason there are 12 apostles in the New Testament is because there are 12 apostles. Much more reasonable.
Right.
Apollonius of Tyana, his second favorite example. It's claimed that he was a miracle worker. He was. By the way, Apollonius probably was an actual person, unlike all the others on the list. All right, a Pythagorean city in Tyana in the first century A.D. He saved a friend in Corinth. All right, he predicted a plague in Ephesus. He says, "Stone this beggar to death to end the plague." And they do, and when they remove the stones, they find a large dog alive and well. Apollonius disappears, and he's never seen again. So that's the analogy to Jesus. They got the story of Jesus. There's a problem with this, because Apollonius lived near the end of the first century, and the only account we have of him is from the fourth century. So they're claiming that they stole the story of Jesus from him, when the Gospels were written before he was alive. I don't know. That seems, I don't know about you, but that seems a little bit of a stretch to me.
Right.
Yes.
Now, we could go back to this list. All right, we go back to this list. Now, there's a difference between Jesus and Adonis, Osiris, Thammuz, Dionysus, Mithra, Krishna, I'll skip Apollonius and all the other Hercules, Romulus. There's a difference. All right, Krishna. That's a God-man myth. Where was Krishna born? I don't know. Where was he born? I don't know. What was his mother's name? I don't know. What was his father's name? I don't know. You know? We know nothing about this guy. You know why we know nothing about this guy? Because he didn't exist. We know where Jesus was born. We know where he lived. We know where he died. We know when he died. We know how he died. We know the name of his mother, his father, three of his brothers. We know the names of several of his best friends. I mean, the idea that he's a myth, I'm going to go on to the next thing, all right? There's a lot of stuff here. I'm going to skip some of it, okay? That Jesus had more influence. Let's see here. Acts of Peter, blah, blah, blah. Given Jesus' claims about himself, given the historical evidence, both from Christian and pagan sources, given the strong evidence that Jesus worked signs and wonders and miracles, given the quality and quantity of his witnesses, given the fulfillment of clear messianic prophecies, which you'll see later on, given the evidence for the resurrection, I think Jesus is the Son of God. That's my conclusion. All right. Now, I've got a whole section on miracles here. Oh, man. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, the miracle, you know, that was a miracle. 9 points in 11 seconds. No, that was not a miracle. A miracle, by definition, would be an event that is a clear violation of the natural law. All right, so when he fed 5,000, that was a miracle. Water to wine. I'm thinking, are there enough carbon atoms in water that you can kind of reconstitute it and turn it into, you know, sugar? I don't think so. That's a miracle. All right, the miracle. I'm old at Miracle Mets. That's an old example. Anybody remember the Miracle Mets? No. I was a Mets fan. Grew up. All right, anyway, how about the guy rescued after 28 days in Haiti? Was that a miracle? No, that was awesome. That was amazing. But it wasn't a miracle. Okay. Let's see here. Miracles. There's so much stuff about miracles. Let me see. I just want to get one slide here. Okay. Blah, blah, blah. Miracles. There's lots of stuff about miracles. Way too much stuff. I have to skip probably. Uh-oh. This thing stopped forwarding now. All right. Miracles of timing. Come on. It's not going forward anymore. Come on. It's dying on me. We need a resurrection here. I'm going to catch up at least here. Is it working yet? All right. I'm going to continue on here. Now, the way I see it, there's four possibilities. One, Jesus never worked miracles. Neither did he claim to work miracles. That's one possibility. Another possibility is he claimed to work miracles, but he was a liar. The third possibility is he worked genuine miracles, but by the power of Satan. The fourth possibility is he worked genuine miracles, and he was who he said he was. They verify who he said he was, which is God. Now, what about the claim that he never worked miracles, nor claimed to work miracles? Well, that's made a lie by the sources, even pagan sources. He claimed to work miracles, but he's a liar. Well, you know, they said that to Jesus. They said, but how could he have worked these miracles if he's a charlatan or a liar? All right? I believe the evidence is clear that Jesus worked miracles. And not only is it clear that he worked miracles, the only reasonable conclusion. All right, here's the slide that I wanted. Okay, great. I'm going to list six reasons to believe that Jesus worked miracles. And you're not going to be able to write it down because I'm going to talk too fast. And then I'm going to talk about messianic prophecies, and then we'll take a break for lunch. Okay? Reason to believe Jesus worked miracles, number one. A great number of miracles were done publicly, often in front of the greatest skeptics and the harshest critics. That's not the same as the supposed miracles that go on in certain churches. You know? So, it is a historical fact, that Jesus did these things, however he did them, whatever he did it in front of thousands of people. including the greatest skeptics and the harshest critics. Okay? Number two. There were tens of thousands of eyewitnesses from every background to these events. Number three, the apostles openly proclaimed that Jesus worked miracles to a great variety of people during the lifetime of those who could have refuted the claims. Number four, both Roman and Jewish histories report at least the general fact that Jesus worked miracles. Number four, the Pharisees and rabbis did not deny the miracles, but instead tried to explain them away. And number six, those who record the miracles as eyewitnesses have every appearance of being credible. I think I've established all of those. All right. Now, let me. I've got a bunch of stuff on the miracles I just don't have time for. I'm going to skip down to the messianic prophecies. Okay? So, is it working yet? It is. Seems to be, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Could you skip me down about 78 slides so I don't have to go one at a time here?
Yeah.
It's going to be near the bottom. Like, you could almost go to the very end and come back up about 20 slides.
Yeah, it's trying to do all
that. Alright. Here we go. I want to talk about the prophecies about the Messiah. Jesus in Luke 24:44, he said, everything that was written about me, I have to fulfill everything that was written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms. Luke 24:44. So he publicly said that he is or has or will fulfill every prophecy written about the Messiah. Now let's try to take the skeptical view. All right. Let's try to take the skeptical view here. All right. We could ask, how do we know that these things were actually written before Jesus lived? Number one. Number two, how do we know that Jesus really did these things? Maybe it was just the believers who wrote it down, and, you know, but there's no non-believers who don't believe it happened. All right? Number three, how do we know that Jesus, wanting to claim to be the Messiah, perhaps did these things? He read the Old Testament, says the Messiah is going to do this, so he did it in order to claim he was the Messiah. And number four, how do we know these prophecies are really about the Messiah? Those are the four questions. Number one, how do we know these things were written before? All right, rather than they wrote it afterward and as a way to say that Jesus is the Messiah. How do we know that he really did these things? Maybe he did these things in order to be able to claim to be the Messiah. And number four, what was number four? Right. I got the four. Do you mind write those four down? All right. Anyway. Maybe it was a conspiracy and anyway, doesn't matter. Alright, so number one, how do we know these things were really written down before Jesus did them? What we have is the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we have the Septuagint translation. So, for example, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have a copy of Isaiah from roughly 250 BC. The Septuagint was the Greek translation from Hebrew to Greek of the Old Testament. We know that that translation was made around 250 to 230 BC. So what we can say as a fact, as an absolute undisputable fact, is either the entire Old Testament or nearly the entire Old Testament was written by 250 BC. Now, I believe it was written quite a bit earlier than that. But what we have is the undisputable fact that the Old Testament was written hundreds of years before Jesus was born. Okay, now, how do we know Jesus actually did these things? Maybe it was just believers who made it up. Now, we're going to look at a number of prophecies. And over half of the prophecies we're going to look at are a matter of historical fact, external to the Bible. So the fact that Jesus fulfilled these prophecies is historical fact. And of course, never mind the fact that probably these people were reliable, but let's even ignore that for a minute. All right, how about the possibility that Jesus did these things in order to be able to... how's it working? Is it not going forward at all? Oh, rats. Oh, well. These pictures would be nice, but... All right, so here's what I'm going to do then is I'm going to... where is it? You know what? I think I might have the wrong PowerPoint for this. It's all right. Sorry about that. This is not the best thing in the world, but... okay, Messianic Prophecies. I'm going to go to that one. Okay. Sorry about that. We're going to have to work on the technology over lunch.
Yeah.
We'll get it working. I'm pretty sure we can just put my computer back there. All right. So, pretend there's this awesome picture of the Qumran Cave number 4. Pretend there's this really cool picture of one of the great Isaiah scroll here. All right. How do I know these things really happened? We already saw Josephus reporting the death under Pontius Pilate, etc. All right. Fine. So let's go to Isaiah 53, 1 through 13. Isaiah 53, 1 through 13. I'll start in verse 3. Now, remember, one of the that's the fourth one. I forgot. It's, how do we know this is a messianic prophecy? In other words, how do we know that the Christians are not reading the Old Testament and saying, I don't know, they're kind of looking around to find parallel, all right, that thing, we're going to say that's about the Messiah, and Jesus did it, there you go. Okay, the best way to know this is to ask, did the Jews, before the time of Jesus, say that this was a prophecy of the Messiah? We know that the Jews themselves said Isaiah 53 was a prophecy of their Messiah, as with Micah 5, as with several of the others we're going to look at here. So whether or not this was a messianic prophecy is established simply by the fact that the Jews themselves says, yes, this is a prophecy about our Messiah. The fact that this was written beforehand is clear. Whether or not Jesus could have faked this, well, let's see. Verse 3. He was despised and rejected by men. All right, there's a prophecy about the Messiah. Now, is it a historical fact that Jesus was despised and rejected?
Yeah.
I mean, we know that even without using the Bible? Yeah, that's a historical fact. Could Jesus, thinking, all right, I want to start a movement, I want to get people to follow me, so in order to claim to be the Messiah, I have to get despised and rejected. Could Jesus have done that? Yeah. In fact, if you want to get despised and rejected, go into Jerusalem and say to the Pharisees, you whitewash tombs.
That's right.
All right, so I'll concede that one to the skeptics. I'll concede that, yes, this is a messianic prophecy. Yes, Jesus fulfilled it, obviously. It's a historical fact. But I'll concede that possibly this was a fulfillment because of him trying to manipulate the people in history. Okay, fine. All right, let's go on to the next one. Let me see. Let's go down to verse 5. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. All right? Now, we do know that Jesus was crucified. All right? Could Jesus have arranged that? Now, we'll go to Psalms 22. Could Jesus have arranged that? Could Jesus have arranged to get crucified? Well, that's kind of challenging. All right? Now, let's imagine Jesus is thinking, what I'm going to do is, I'm going to read Isaiah 53. It says, all right, I have to be silent before my accusers. Mm-hmm. Jesus was silent before his accusers. Could he have been silent before his accusers in order to be able to claim to be the Messiah? Yes. What's the problem with that? If you're silent before your accusers, what happens to you? You get killed.
Yeah.
And then you get killed, and then you don't have a whole lot of a movement to, you know. I suppose. I mean, if this guy was crazy, then maybe just possibly. Maybe just possibly. He was oppressed and afflicted, verse 7, yet did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, as a sheep before a shearer is silent. So he did not open his mouth, verse 7. All right? Now, if all we had was Isaiah 53, 1 through 13, maybe, possibly, the skeptic could have some grounds for defending not that Jesus didn't fulfill the prophecy, but that maybe he was doing it in order to sort of be able to start a movement and claim he's the Messiah. Okay, I'll concede that one. What about Micah 5, verse 2? Micah 5, 2. Micah 5, verse 2. All right, but you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will rule over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. And then if you read on, this is clearly a messianic prophecy. He will stand and shepherd his flock and strengthen the Lord, etc. The Jews throughout time have agreed this was a messianic prophecy. In fact, even during the time of Jesus, they told him that the Messiah had to come from Bethlehem. Now, where was Jesus born? Bethlehem. How do you know that? Well, that's a fact. That's a fact of history. Now, remember, one argument is Jesus is trying to arrange to fulfill the messianic prophecies. So one of the things he's got to do is he's got to make sure he gets born in Bethlehem. Now, could Jesus have arranged to have been born in Bethlehem?
No.
Well, the answer is yes, if he's God. But that kind of messes up their whole argument.
Right.
Okay? So that's a little... By the way, there are two Bethlehems. There's the larger one, and then the smaller one, Bethlehem Ephrathah, the one that Jesus was born in. How about Isaiah 9? Here's where I really, really wish that this thing was working. Oh, I need to hold up my computer. That's terrible, but... All right, Isaiah 9. Isaiah 9, verse 1. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the sea along the Jordan. And you go on in verse 6, it's talking about wonderful counselor, mighty God, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Basically, what he's saying is the Messiah is going to come from the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. Now, you'd have to have one of these Bible maps. It's a lot better to have the map up on the screen. But if you go to your Bible maps in the back, I don't know. Here you go. Zebulun and Naphtali. Those are up there by the Sea of Galilee. And if you look where Zebulun is, if you look where Naphtali is, if you then look at a map of Israel during the time of Jesus, guess where Nazareth is? It's right on the border between Zebulun and Naphtali. So it's interesting. If you want to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem. All right? But you have to come from the region of Zebulun and Naphtali, kind of near Nazareth there. All right? All right. How many people, anybody here qualified? In fact, how many people living today, on the earth today, were born in Bethlehem, but actually came from the area of Galilee, west of Galilee, there between. Not too many qualified on that ground. Of course, in order to claim to be the Messiah, you also have to get pierced. You also have to be silent before your accusers. All right? And you also have to be despised and rejected. And some of you are saying, well, despised and rejected, I got that one covered. All right? Got that one covered. The possible candidates are getting pretty small here. Psalms 22. By the way, I know some of you are familiar with these arguments. You know, this is not brand new for some of you. I understand that. It's still pretty cool arguments, though. All right, Psalm 22. The fact that it's tried and true doesn't mean it doesn't work. In fact, that's part of why it's tried and true, because it works. Psalm 22. Now, that this is a messianic prophecy, I would say it's a fact that Isaiah 53, Micah 5, and Isaiah 9, those are messianic prophecies. The Jews would agree with that themselves. That Psalm 22 is a messianic prophecy is not quite as much of a slam dunk, but let's read it. All right, let me see. Verse 15, my strength is dried up like a potsherd. My tongue stiffs to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men have encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. All right. Now, imagine you're David writing 1000 B.C. Right? They've cast lots for my clothing. The bands of evil men have encircled me. Well, I guess that happened to David. They pierced my hands and my feet. I try to imagine David writing this down and kind of going, what did I just write? They pierced my hands and my feet. Okay. I can count all my bones. Why did I just write that down? All right, I would say this is clearly a messianic prophecy in that it's certainly not about David. Did you know that crucifixion wasn't invented until around 350 B.C.? Didn't even exist. Crucifixion didn't exist for 600 years after David died. And even then, the Persians who invented crucifixion, they didn't pierce hands and feet. It was the Romans. It was somewhere around 100 B.C. or so. We have the first record of people piercing hands and feet.
Great.
Wow. All right, now, could Jesus have arranged this to happen? Could Jesus have arranged to get crucified? Well, that's an interesting question. I guess, certainly, when he raised Lazarus from the dead and said he's the resurrection and life, his death was inevitable. But by crucifixion?
Correct.
By stoning?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. By crucifixion? Because the Jews couldn't even arrange it. In fact, it was quite a trick. They needed to get him crucified. I like to think about the Pharisees later on going, man, should have stoned him to death. And that soldier, man, we should have said, no, don't pierce his side. Don't pierce his side.
Oh,
then we get to Zechariah. You know, they're counting out those pieces of silver. They should go, oh, man, 30 pieces. Okay, I can count all my bones. What's that about? Well, John 19 describes that, you know, they wanted to end the crucifixion because it was the eve of the Passover. They broke the two legs. They didn't break Jesus' leg. By the way, the Jews, when they eat the Passover, they still don't break the bones of the lamb.
Mm-hmm.
All right, for the same reason, as a prophecy. It says, they divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. That's John 19, 23 and 24. Now, which is it? Did they divide the garments, one for you, one for you, one for me? Or did they gamble? Which is it? Both. Now, I'll admit that that's only recorded in the gospel. It's not recorded by anybody else. But again, liars don't give such details that can be easily disproved by the dozens of eyewitnesses. Unless you can give me reason to think that John is flat out lying, I believe it's actually true. I think the reason John wrote it is not because he didn't believe in Jesus. Really? So you think he wrote that because he didn't believe in Jesus? Because he's a liar and he's trying to, you know, get lots of money and fame and fortune? So, you know, for himself. No, I think he wrote it because it actually happened. All right? Let me see. Next. How about Zechariah 11? 12 and 13. Zechariah 11. Hosea, Joelmus, Obadiah, Jonah, and Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah. There you go. Right before Malachi. And we're skipping a lot of these. A lot of these. They're all over the place. I still find new messianic prophecies that I'm reading all the time. Zechariah 11, 12, and 13. Here we go. So I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay. But if not, keep it. So they paid me 30 pieces of silver. How many?
30.
You sure it's 30? It's not 29? It's not 31? It's not 46? 30. Why 30? I don't know. 30. Now, how many pieces of silver did Judas get for betraying Jesus? 30. How do we know that? The reason we know that is because the Pharisee said it. It wasn't a future Christian. Well, actually, Josephus was there, probably, I guess. I mean, put it this way. If it wasn't 30 pieces, then they certainly wouldn't have put it in the New Testament.
Right.
That would have been a foolish plan. We'll put it in 30 because, you know, again, the skeptics say they made that up. They made that up. But if they made it up when most of the people who were there in the room were still alive, that could have refuted that. So, no, I'm sorry. It was 30 pieces of silver. All right. The handsome price at which they priced me. Let's read on here. The Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. The handsome price at which they priced me. So they took the 30 pieces of silver and threw it into the house of the Lord to the potter. Now, you know the story, right? Judas came in. He basically was repenting in his own way. He didn't fully repent, unfortunately. He realized it was a mistake. It didn't work. He's trying to get Jesus to rebel, but he didn't. Instead, he got killed. So he throws the money in there. They say, we can't take that money. And what do? They bought the potter's field. Now you can say, well, they just made that up so that it'll fulfill Zechariah 11. That doesn't work. Because that would mean they're putting a detail in there that can obviously be proved wrong by dozens of eyewitnesses. In fact, the potter's field was there to that very day, like he said. But the last one, and then we'll break for lunch. Daniel 9. Daniel 9, starting in verse 24. Seventy sevens. Daniel 9:24. 77s are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. By the way, that word anoint is Messiah. So if there was ever a messianic prophecy, clearly it's Daniel 9. It's as clear a messianic prophecy as there could possibly be. No one understands this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens, 67s. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble, and it goes on. All right, now, was there ever an issue, the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? What about Cyrus? In 538 B.C. All right, well, that's in Ezra chapter 1, by the way. Cyrus said, go back and build the temple. And then in 517 B.C., also in the book of Ezra, Darius said, go back and build the temple, because they hadn't built the temple. Then in Ezra chapter 7, in verse 12, there's the decree of Artaxerxes to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. So we have a record in the Old Testament, all right, historical record saying, go back and rebuild the city of Jerusalem, 458 B.C. Now, 70 times 7, we have a math major here, can you do that? 70 times 7? 490. 490, okay. So let's subtract 490 from 458. We get negative 32, all right? In other words, 32 A.D., right? No, wrong, because there's no year zero. Okay, so in other words, the Messiah is going to come to Jerusalem, put an end to sin and prophecy, seal up vision of prophecy, and they're going to anoint the Most Holy, the year 33 A.D. Oh, well, no, not exactly. If you read the prophecy carefully, it says after, let's read it a little bit more carefully, it says, after 7 sevens and 62 sevens. In other words, after 69 sevens during the 70th. In other words, during the last week. Somewhere between 26 A.D. and 33 A.D. In fact, exactly in the middle of that. Because Jesus was killed in 30 A.D. So if Jesus wanted to claim to be the Messiah, he had to come into Jerusalem and get killed in about 30 A.D. In fact, if anybody wants to claim to be the Messiah, they have to get born in Bethlehem. Okay? They have to come from Galilee in the region near Nazareth. They have to get despised and rejected. They have to be silent when they're being accused. They have to get pierced and crucified. Pierced and crucified. They have to have their garments divided and gambled over. They have to get betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. They have to ride into Jerusalem on a donkey, actually on the colt, the foal of a donkey, actually, if you want to be exact. They have to come to Jerusalem in roughly 30 A.D. All right? So, I don't know. How would you explain the fact that Jesus fulfilled all those prophecies? All right. Somebody yesterday mentioned this 1 and times 10 to the 17th. Those numbers don't really mean anything, in my opinion. That's nice. You can't calculate these numbers. Jesus is the Messiah. And if you don't think so, have to understand that all these things were written hundreds of years before he was born. Over half on the list are a matter of historical fulfillment, even never mind what the apostle writers wrote. I only use prophecies that are clearly messianic, not debatable ones. And the very idea that Jesus could have arranged this in order to say he fulfilled the prophecies, that is ludicrous. So my conclusion is that Jesus is who he said he was. He worked miracles. He died for our sins. And we'll talk about him being raised from the dead after the lunch break. Okay? Should we take questions now or at the after the lunch break? Who's in charge here? Now?
Let's do it now. Yeah.
All right, now. Okay, go ahead.
By current Jews today, do they still accept the book of Isaiah?
Yes. Yeah. What they've done, though, is before the time of Christ, they included many messianic prophecies. You know, like Catholics or Lutherans, they have their daily readings and their weekly readings. They included many messianic prophecies in their daily and weekly readings, but gradually they removed them from their rotation of readings after the time of Christ for reasons that you and I can imagine, okay? But no, absolutely, the Jews have the same exact Bible we have.
Have you heard, I mean, I don't know where I heard that from. Is there certain groups that...
No, there are some Jews that focus in only on the first five books, the Pentateuch, but Orthodox, Reform, conservative Jews all use the same Old Testament we use, and it's the exact same Bible. The Jewish Bible has the books in different order. That doesn't change anything. No, they have the exact same Bible. Now, certain Christian groups included the Apocrypha, but the Jews never did. The Apocrypha entered the Old Testament because of Christian influence, not because of Jewish influence. Okay? Yep? Yeah?
How do you argue when people use Isaiah 53 and they say that that was a prophecy or that was said about Israel?
I think it was said about Israel, but Israel didn't. I believe this idea of a double prophecy is a possible thing. It's a concept that happens, but if you look at the details apply very loosely in a certain sense to Israel, but they apply very specifically and very exactly and undeniably to Jesus. And certain parts of it don't even make sense in application to Jesus. So I wouldn't just say, oh, that's a stupid idea. Because, you know, a lot of the prophecies, I'm studying Ezekiel right now, a lot of the prophecies in Ezekiel were about the restoration of Israel to the land. And yet they're also about the church and about the kingdom of God and they're messianic. They're both. But they're more... deeply and accurately in every way more about the Messiah than they are about the immediate circumstance. So I'd say for the average Christian, I'd just say, no, that's not true. And it's just about Jesus. That's the easy answer. But I think that if somebody really knows what they're talking, if they really do, most people don't, but if they really do, then I would give the more nuanced answer there. But if you go to Isaiah 53, certain things don't make sense in any kind of Jewish perspective that I can at least think of. All right, for he bore the sins of many and made intercession for the transgressors. How could that be applied to Israel? It just doesn't really make any sense. All right, is it true that Israel was silent when accused? Not that I know of. Maybe. Was Israel pierced for their transgression? Okay. Okay, I could see that. So I think that as a foreshadowing, which is something that's all over the Old Testament, things that happened in the Old Testament to the Jews were, in a sense, a prefiguring or foreshadowing of Jesus. So I wouldn't completely deny the idea. They'll also say the virgin will be with child. They'll say that's about Josiah's son. For all I know, it could possibly have been a prophecy that Josiah's wife would have a male child. It's possible. But one thing I know is his son was not everlasting father, mighty God, prince of peace. So the concept of double prophecy, I wouldn't completely reject. But the bottom, here's the typical, those who want to ignore this, what they'll refuse to do is look at the big picture. They simply won't do it. So if, for example, I go back to this slide that's not up there, but if I go to this slide, that to be born in Bethlehem, blah, 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 rejected by men, signed before he was pierced, crucified, that whole picture, they'll just, that's the only possible response. So really, all they can really do is take each one at a time and try to cut that one apart. For example, Psalm 22, when it says, let me go to Psalms 22. The way they respond to this, it's almost funny. I have to remember the deal. I think it's the part where they says, I can count all my bones. Apparently, the Hebrew word for bones can also be translated as camels or something like that. So they'll say, no, that's camels. I can count all my camels. You know, they do kind of stuff that, like, for anybody doing any reasonable kind of hermeneutics, you go, oh, come on. You know, if a Christian scholar was trying to interpret this thing and do it, and sort of totally taking something out of context, we'd laugh at it. But skeptics do this, and I guess they get a break or something like that. So what they'll do is they'll take each one at a time and try to explain that one away, ignoring the fact that they have to actually explain 20 different things away all at the same time, all reasonably. And at that point, their arguments just don't work. So that's the typical reaction to the messianic prophecies, is to refuse to even consider the possibility that we have to look at them as a whole. That's what Jesus said. He said, in Luke 24:44, he said, I fulfilled all of them. And so what Jews will typically try to do is they'll say, well, he didn't fulfill this one. He didn't fulfill the one to bring peace to Israel. Oh, yes, he did. Oh, yes, he did. He didn't fulfill the one that had the lamb lying down with the lion. Oh, yes, he did. Look around the church right here. We got the lamb lying down. So that's another approach. They'll try to change the subject in a sense. They'll try to ignore all these things that Jesus fulfilled, and they'll try to find prophecy that he didn't fulfill. But the fact is, he fulfilled every single one of them. And they just misinterpret the meaning of the prophecy. All right? Because, of course, you're aware that the Jews expected their Messiah to come as a conquering warrior with armies, but that's a misinterpretation. Okay? Next? Yeah?
Well, I was kind of answering after that, but I was going to ask, you know, it's, to my understanding, Jews and Muslims both believe that Jesus wasn't the Messiah, but he was a great prophet.
Jews don't believe that at all. Are you kidding?
I don't think he could at all.
No, they think he was an enemy, a liar, a worker of false miracles. No, they do not believe he's a prophet.
Okay.
Now, the Muslims claim he's a prophet.
Right.
But Jews certainly don't. Far from it.
I guess the question I have is then where, if they, I'm assuming they ignore Christian texts.
Yes.
And there's the few historical texts that is written out at this time. I mean, I guess where else, are there any other sources where they get, like, okay, he is a Christian and he did these things?
Well, their source is called the Quran. So the Quran, Muhammad was fairly well, I would say Muhammad was moderately well acquainted with Judaism. And if you read the Quran, you can see that right away. And he was very peripherally aware of Christianity. And there was a large Jewish colony living in Medina. There were Christians in Arabia at the time of Muhammad. But apparently there are few, if any, in Mecca or Medina in the immediate area. And down in the southwest corner near what we call Yemen, there was a fairly significant Christian population there. And so his knowledge of Judaism was moderate. His knowledge of Christianity was just, it was mainly of a corrupted kind of Christianity. So his view of Jesus, he has Jesus working miracles as a baby. That's kind of from the apocryphal gospels and that kind of stuff. So the reason that a Muslim say Jesus was a prophet is because they have no choice, otherwise they have to reject the Quran. All right, now they're in a spot here. The Muslims are in a big spot because if Jesus is a prophet, then we obviously have to believe what he said.
Right.
And then if you read the Gospels, what he said, then you can't possibly be a Muslim, that's for sure. So they absolutely have to reject the New Testament. All right? So probably Muslims spend more time trying to disprove the New Testament even than typically atheists and other skeptics. All right? Now, their treatment tends to be extremely shallow, and it's interesting because they'll say Muhammad is the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 18. They'll say Muhammad is the fulfillment of John 15, which just doesn't make sense because their basic thrust is they try to disprove that the Bible is reliable. Okay? Why? By the way, the Quran says, follow the Injil. Follow the New Testament. It says, in the Quran, it says to Christians, you obey the gospel. It says to the Muslims, obey what I'm saying to Muhammad. But it says to the Christians, obey the gospel. Now, that was probably earlier on in his career, not later, because later he probably wouldn't have said that. After he kind of started to realize, that's not going to work too well. I just murdered a bunch of Jews. It's not. But earlier on, in the Quran, it clearly says those kind of things. But anyway, the Quran is very, very clear that Jesus is not God and that he was not crucified. Never mind the fact that historical sources such as Tacitus and just such as Josephus tell us he was crucified. So what they're saying is the people who knew Jesus, who lived with Jesus, who his mother, his brother, they don't know what happened to Jesus. They're totally wrong. And Muhammad, who lived 600 years later, who never met him and never met anybody who knew him, that he actually knew what happened to Jesus and those guys did not. Now that's clearly crazy. But that's the only way you can be a Muslim and really interact with those who know the New Testament is to make that claim. That Peter didn't write Peter, that John didn't write John, that, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay. Some of us are hungry. Yeah. All right, last question.
Got a few more minutes.
Oh, okay. But if then, I'll start talking about the resurrection then. All right. Don't give me permission to keep going, Vince. That's a bad idea. All right. Go ahead.
So, if the Jews don't even see Jesus as a prophet and they have the same Old Testament as us, I was wondering what's their reason for not sacrificing anymore?
The reason they don't sacrifice anymore is because they don't have a temple. And despite certain right-wing religious Christian groups saying that the temple is going to be rebuilt, that's premillennialism. Don't even go there. That's the problem with that is you'd have to tear down the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Good luck with that one. All right. So the temple was destroyed in 70 A.D. And then there's the Bar Kokhba Rebellion in 130-something A.D. At that point, after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., basically the city was leveled, the temple was destroyed, no more sacrifices. The Jews kind of filtered back into Jerusalem. But after the Bar Kokhba Rebellion in the 2nd century, the Romans kicked all the Jews. There were no Jews at all in Jerusalem for a time. They did filter in some later. And so there was no way they could offer sacrifices. So they didn't. So then the next question would be, well, then how do Jews explain the fact that they don't offer sacrifices anymore? Well, you'd have to ask a Jew about that. Already by the time of Jesus, a significant portion of Judaism was looking not as much to the temple, but more to the rabbis and the synagogues and those kinds of things. So the Pharisees did not emphasize the temple so much because the Sadducees controlled the temple. So already the Pharisees were building a kind of Judaism that didn't rely on the temple as much as in previous times. So the transition to, not even relying on these sacrifices at all was not quite as ridiculously sharp as you might think. Because remember, the Sadducees controlled the temple. The Pharisees were not even involved in those things. Yeah?
Did you just say, you said that the mosque would have to be torn down.
Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is right on the site of the temple.
That's not the Dome of the Rock. That's not what the Muslims call the...
That's the same thing.
Same thing. Okay, got it.
Yeah, sorry. Same thing. That cool-looking thing with the golden... Yeah. That's right on the site of the temple that, you know, that Herod built.
Right.
Yeah.
Now there is some, there is maybe some excavating going on.
There's a lot there, yeah.
What the Jews are trying to find, and then there's, seems like among the Muslim community, a fear that they're trying to collapse the Dome of the Rock.
Yeah, I don't think the Jews are trying to do that. There's in certain nationalities in the world, there's a more willingness to believe conspiracy theories. Certain parts of the world, I'm not going to name the countries and the places, but there's certain parts of the world that are extremely subject to conspiracy theories. And the people that you're mentioning are, if you go to that part of the world, you kind of go, seriously? All right? These are the same people that believe that the planes going into the World Trade Center, where that was an American conspiracy. You know? So, sure. I'm sure that conspiracy is out there. Does the Jewish government do some pretty underhanded stuff? Yes. I'm sure they're not trying to do that, though. That'd be so foolish for them to do that. Why would they do that? So anyway, personally, I don't believe that rumor. All right, any other questions? See, people are just tired, so they can't come up with questions. Yeah?
I forget your outline, so if there's a better time to ask this question, I don't want to sidetrack the mentality. But nonetheless, I run into a lot of people that, like, I know the Apocrypha has great historical context because of Maccabees, gives a lot of context to the Maccabees and the revolt.
All right.
Sorry, that's why I'm saying.
Sure.
Better time to ask this question.
No, but right now, why not? Any questions?
But nonetheless, I know a lot of people who don't really know much about the Apocrypha.
Yeah.
They still seem to be indignant that it's not included in.
Who's indignant that it's not included?
This is what I'm saying. It's one of those kind of, the people who kind of throw out random. It's the people who don't really know much about why it's not included in the Apocrypha.
Is this a Catholic person, an atheist, a Jew, what's their question going to be?
It's just, well, that's what I'm saying is, you go into them and you ask them to study the Bible, they start throwing out all these things of that they have issue with the church, and this sense of this Apocrypha not being included in the Bible, for me it comes up, I've had at least a half a dozen people toss it out as a complaint.
I think it's just a total smokescreen. Because I don't believe this person actually thinks the Apocrypha should be included. I think they're just throwing out a smokescreen. Nevertheless, as the Bible says, we should be prepared to answer, and we need to give reasonable answers even when we know it's not even a genuine question. All right. So, see, one person would use the Apocrypha as evidence that they were writing all this stuff. A bunch of it's just junk, so it's all junk, so obviously the Old Testament is junk. That would be the total opposite person than the person I think you're describing, who's saying, your Bible's not complete because it doesn't have the Apocrypha. Okay? Yeah, again, I don't see too many of the, if those people are common, they'd be coming to my website a lot, so I'm having trouble figuring out who you're talking about. But let me try my best to answer that question. Okay, now first of all, My response to the canon is, if the way I understand it is, God used the Christian church, the consensus of the Christian church, to establish the canon of the New Testament. And God used the consensus not of the Jews as a whole, but of the Jewish teachers and scribes to choose the content of the Old Testament. And what I can say, without a doubt, is the Jews never accepted those books. They never accepted any of those books. We have proceedings of their conferences in which they even raised that, and they were all adamant. They're all adamant. So there's no possible justification for including these books in the Old Testament. Now, the only people who did try to include them were the Christians. It wasn't the Jews, it was the Christians. And clearly Jesus did not consider them inspired because he never quoted them. In fact, none of the New Testament writers ever quoted any of the Apocrypha. The only exception is Jude, who quoted not one of the Apocrypha, the additions to the Catholic Bible. He quoted 1 Enoch, which is not even in the Catholic Bibles. It's in the Coptic Bibles, not in the Catholic Bibles. So clearly the apostles and Jesus did not consider these canonical. However, by as early as the 2nd century, some of the church fathers are starting to use Wisdom of Sirach, Judith, these Maccabees and all that kind of stuff. If you look at these things, you can see why, because, for example, there's in Ecclesiasticus, there's a statement that sins are atoned for through almsgiving, things like that. Yeah, so it was the early church. By the 4th century, the church as a whole had accepted these books and were using them. Not part of the New Testament, obviously, part of the Old Testament. And so that's how this came into place. In fact, the evidence is probably the Jews even more adamantly rejected them than ever before, because as a statement against the church, which were using these, they're like, why are you using these books? All right, now we come to the writing of the creation of the Vulgate translation. That's Jerome, 390-something A.D., something like that. Jerome, he was asked to translate the Greek Septuagint into Latin. And he was a scholar. He didn't want to do that. He wanted to translate from the Hebrew, so he did. He was a pretty good scholar. He was kind of a prideful, angry type guy, but he was a great scholar. And so basically he rejected all these books. Not just because the Jews didn't accept them, but because of the evidence in the books themselves, the quality of them, the fact that they weren't even originally in Hebrew. They were either originally in Aramaic or Greek. So on several grounds, he wanted to exclude them from the Old Testament. Unfortunately, the church as a whole refused to let him do that because they've been using it. The church fathers have been using it for a long time. So it entered into the Catholic Bible. The Vulgate translation became the Bible of Western Christianity indefinitely. The Coptic Church accepted slightly different list of books. The Orthodox Church accepted a slightly different list of books, but all of them included some of what we call the Apocrypha. You can read them for yourselves. If you're wanting, just read Tobit and kind of go, okay. Read 2 Maccabees. At the end of 2 Maccabees, he says, I've done a very good job in my history there, and sorry about all my mistakes, but I did the best I could. But anyway, here it is. All right, can you imagine that at the end of 2 Chronicles? I mean, seriously. Now, there are varying qualities. In my opinion, as you alluded to, you obviously know more than probably even most people about the Apocrypha that are here. You alluded to Maccabees. First Maccabees is first-rate history, unlike Second Maccabees. And for all I know, First Maccabees might even be inspired by God. Did Paul write any other inspired letters? I'm sure he did.
Yeah.
I'm sure he did, but they're not in the New Testament. And at some point, I have to kind of go, all right, I personally believe God's in control of things. Now, he doesn't force everybody to do everything they don't want to do, but there's certain things I believe by faith that God clearly kind of influenced. And that would include what ended up in the Old and the New Testament. So that's a faith issue. That's not an evidence issue. So I say, whether 1 Maccabees is inspired or not doesn't really matter that much to me. Not really. It's a cool book. I read it. I believe it's accurate history. I do believe it tells us something about what God was doing at that time. But then you read Ecclesiasticus, Wisdom of Sirach, and you kind of go, I don't know about that. There's talk about women not being so great. And, there's some clear false doctrine there. Okay? So if people want to include them, if somebody wants to include them in their Bible, I don't care. Include them in your Bible. It doesn't matter. That is not an argument that I would engage in. I just give them a little bit of information and say, hey, if you don't agree, that's not a big deal. Let's read the Gospel of John. Okay?
Right.
On that note, we'll take a break.
Always say a prayer for our food, Joe. Ethan from Wichita.
Ethan.
Father God, thank you so much for blessing us with this time with a scholar like John Oakes, Father. Thank you so much for allowing all of us to get here safely, Father.
Mm-hmm.
Pray for those who couldn't make it or are on their way, God. Be safe. God bless this food we are about to eat. God, you bless it by giving it to us, Father. We are so grateful. Help us to continue the rest of the day, the rest of the time here with open, vulnerable hearts to your word and to this information, Father. Help us to transform our lives. And put a fire in our chest for my father. I bless my back and plead of you. Please do that, Father. It's only since I'm a breath.
Amen.
Amen. All right, there's lunch downstairs. There should be someone down there with some instructions.
Instructions are to eat it.
We've got an hour. 1 hour for lunch. So let's go ahead and get to it. Oh, by the way, you will also need to go ahead and register with LaShonda here. She's wearing this. And you'll need to give her your $15, and she will collect that from you at some point over the lunch break as well.
Come to me. I cannot
come to you. All right. Let's head on down.
Okay.
I just thought about this when you were speaking. This is probably the first question. Yeah, like all these different arguments. How do you, like, Christian decide, like, which one to talk about?
All right. You want to ask that in front of the group when we start the next session? Yeah, everybody should be taken as an individual case.
Yeah. Because that's one thing I noticed, like, how you're speaking, like, when you have different arguments, when you talk to different people, you bring up different arguments. But.
Right, exactly. That comes from experience mainly, but a little bit of common sense, if you think about it.
Yeah, you're not going
to. Yeah, you have to ask some basic questions. What's their worldview? Okay. Is their worldview the Christian worldview, or is it another worldview? If it's another worldview, then probably going directly to the Bible, it may or may not be as effective. Do they believe the Bible is inspired by God or not? These are kinds of questions you need to ask yourself. And you can almost do like a little. What do you call that? A decision-making scheme, like when doctors are doing figuring out what disease you have. You know, you can almost do it like that, kind of yes or no questions to help think about which way to go.
Okay, I got you. Appreciate it.
Okay, now. Yes.
I had a question. I just wanted your opinion on Isaiah 11.
Yeah.
Wondering what they talk about, how all these different animals are going to be in peace together.
Right.
And when I look
that's
at it,
that's symbolic, of course.
I was thinking that it was like the tax collectors and prophets and all this stuff, like they're
sure.
together. But
the,
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Like, talking about Greek and Gentile, slave and free, male, female, centurion and slave. All of them coming together into one kingdom of God that's at peace with one another. It's a kingdom prophecy.
Okay.
And the kingdom of is not of this world, right?
Right.
So it's a prophecy about a place that's not of this world.
Okay. So yeah, I wasn't sure if it was talking about during his lifetime how different, you know, like sinners would be together at one table and learning
right.
from him, or if it
yeah,
was
exactly. That's what it's about.
To come, but also I wanted to know. First Enoch. I was looking into that for a while and seeing why. I was trying to look into all these different books and why they weren't in the canon.
Yeah.
Do you think you could tell me about why that one's not in it?
Ask a Jew, because the Jews get to choose, right? And if the Jews say it's not in the canon, I mean, I could give, you could read First Enoch for yourself, and there's some weird mythological stuff going on. I don't think it has the marks of inspiration. It just doesn't have the marks of inspiration. It doesn't have messianic prophecies. It has ideas that are inconsistent with other things in the Bible. But in the end, it's not canonical because it's not canonical. Because the Jews said it wasn't.
Because I couldn't find any actual, like, text on that. I could only find, like, brief summaries. Whereas, like, other...
You can read First Enoch. It's just... Go on the internet. It's easy to find. It's a little bit long. It's not this little tiny thing. It's fairly long.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
We swapped out computers.
Huh?
We swapped out computers.
All right, good.
We have a much better computer back there now.
Good. Perfect. That's the best.
It's not a $200 Acer.
Yeah.
I know you're being ambushed right now. That's the book from Michael
Burns. Okay, great. So. Yeah. I've actually seen an unprinted version of this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
great.
Give it to you.
How does IP. Okay, good.
Yeah.
I'm so happy.
You're not even actually selling it yet.
Yeah. I was the one who hooked him up with IP.
Did you?
I said to Tony, you got to talk to this guy. He is good.
Oh, my goodness. The way he's awesome.
He's really good.
It goes from God and he's...
Yeah, he's... People need to find out about him. He's in some ways better than me and he's younger than me, so...
Got the great high school teacher.
Yeah. It's funny because I was in Milwaukee when he was there.
Yeah.
And I substituted for his class one time.
Did you really?
He was teaching in the school for crooks and criminals.
For crooks and criminals?
Yeah.
It was an inner city school, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was a school they brought the bad kids from the inner city schools to.
That's where he taught. He didn't tell me that part.
Yes. It was like... It was a zoo. So I taught his class one time. I did a thing on Christian evidence with him.
Really?
That was kind of fun.
It was a Christian school, right?
I don't think so.
Well, maybe not.
I don't think so. It was almost like one step short of juvenile court school.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know if you could teach that. I mean, like...
Yeah, you could.
In a...
Apparently. He pulled it off. I did it. He was a baby Christian back then. He'd been a Christian for less than 6 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was like, I don't know, maybe 16, 17 years ago.
Wow. Yeah. So, yeah, I...
Great. I'm thankful for that.
Thanks for answering that question. Sorry if it's...
Which question? No problem.
I was... referencing more of the smoke screen.
Yeah.
Because it happened more to me in South Africa, but a lot of people just kind of throw it up. And I just...
That's just
a
smoke screen.
I'm like, I don't know why it matters.
It doesn't. And they don't even think it does. They're just throwing it as a smoke screen to appear smart or...
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, it's probably not productive to accuse them of having a bad heart and just
right.
trying to... That's what, you know, Jesus had the similar thing with the woman at the well. And she threw out a smoke screen, and he basically said, that's a smoke screen.
Yeah,
but I don't think that's really how we should handle it.
Yeah. Well, and that's more so my thing. I don't know how to, once there's a smoke screen, do I just kind of...
Well, what I say is, give a, you know, reasonable answer, if you have one, and then change the subject back to what you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, that's all my answers.
You have to get smart.
Too long drawn out.
You have to be smart about how you kind of... Yep. There's a book called Tactics by a guy named Kokel. Tactics by Kokel. I don't really like the book in some ways because it's kind of almost cynical in the way he comes across. But basically, he's trying to give training to how to handle these people and how to not let them set the agenda for the argument and how to sort of restate what they're saying in terms that are not quite so obfuscated,
yeah.
So that it's really more clear what they're actually saying, but then very quickly, you know, how to ask questions, how to refocus the argument, those kinds of things. And again, I would never write that book because it, I don't know, it's like, but it's actually pretty good. You might want to read that.
Tactics by
Kokel. K-O-U-K-L, I think.
K-O-U-K-L. Okay, yeah, because that's most of what I eventually run into. Is you answer all the questions, and then it just comes down to whether or not you're willing to.
Yeah.
Leave it.
Yeah.
That's more so my dilemma.
Yes.
Getting through that.
I know what you're talking about there. All right.
But thanks so much.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Enjoy.
enjoying your class?
Yes, I'm enjoying doing it so far. All right, I have to tell you what the next lesson is going to be. I have 2 5s. Who needs 2 5s? I have 2 5s. All right. Which is the current computer we're using?
I'm the sound guy. I'm just...
Yep. Which computer are we using for the next session there? Oops, I forgot to turn off my... Uh-oh.
Mark, is this going to be a biscuit?
There you go.